The MMQB podcast is brought to you by FanDuel, the leader in one-week fantasy football, with more winners and more payouts than any other site. Enter promo code THEMMQB at FanDuel.com for a bonus match of up to $200. We're also sponsored by the SeatGeek app, the easiest way to find a great deal, pay for your ticket, and get to your seat. Download the SeatGeek app and enter our code MMQB for $20 off your first tickets. The Steelers run the Wildcat and win a game with a walk-off touchdown. I don't know if that sentence has ever been said before.
It felt like a basketball play, like a buzzer beater. How do you develop a guy that's a little bit limited or can't do everything? And that's the question teams spend their entire beings. That's what football's about, is trying to answer that question.
Well, we've got a packed show for you guys today. We appreciate you joining the MMQB podcast with Andy Benoit and myself, Robert Klimko. Both of us writers for Sports Illustrated and the Monday Morning Quarterback. Today, we're going to get into an interview with the boss, Peter King. We're going to preview a few important games from Week 6, and we're going to finish up with your questions on Twitter. But first, we're going to get into some news and notes pertinent to this week's slate of games. The first one, the biggest news in the NFL this week for my money, Kansas City Chiefs running back Jamaal Charles suffers a torn ACL on Sunday. He's out for the year. Beyond the tragedy of seeing one of the great players in the NFL, one of the great ball carriers, go down with a horrific injury, where do we think the 1-4 Chiefs go from here, Andy?
Well, I mean, 1-4 is not a great place to be going anywhere from. I think they can survive this, theoretically. For one, they don't use Charles as much as his skill set would justify. And I'm not saying, like, well, it's okay, he's gone now. But what I am saying is it's an offense that is built to manufacture yardage rather than rely on playmaking ability of just one guy. So this isn't like Adrian Peterson leaving the Vikings, or even to a lesser degree, Le'Veon Bell out of Pittsburgh. Charles is a tremendous creator, but they don't rely on him in that way. I think Niall Davis is a very good player, a chance to, I thought last year watching him on film, he could become top 10 in the league if he ever got his opportunity. And I guess now he has his opportunity.
Well, the two things there that give me pause, I mean, Jamaal Charles currently ranks fifth in the league in yards from scrimmage with 541. So while the offense may not revolve around him, I mean, he's a big piece there that you're certainly going to see some drop off there with him gone. The other thing, I believe that Charkandrick West, the young running back who started the season as a third stringer, is expected to get the most carries there. He was a little bit more explosive than Davis was in Charles's place this past weekend.
Okay, really? Wow. See, that would surprise me. I don't know anything about Charkandrick West. That would be interesting to see, because my knee-jerk reaction is that's a great commentary on him, because I don't think Davis hasn't looked as dynamic this season as I thought he did at times last year. But I don't think that he's a guy that you go away from. So if this West guy, they must like him a lot if what you're saying is he's going to get the bulk of the carries from here.
I think that's been the expectation, but I wouldn't be surprised to see it become a running back by committee thing, especially as soon as one of them fumbles or gets stopped in the backfield a couple times.
Certainly, and you also wonder how much of it, because they're so system-based, how much of it gets down to which guy has the most comfort with the offense. In that case, it would be Davis, I would assume. He's been here since 2013. But they have a lot of defined reads in their offense where the play is this guy or nothing else. And so Andy Reid, if he needs to get away from the running back, has options to do that. Now, those defined plays, again, they become more limited if the opponents aren't focused on your running back as much. Yeah.
Well, the other big injury this week was Bills quarterback Tyrod Taylor. He's expected to miss several games with an MCL sprain. Our old friend EJ Manuel slated to start in Week 6 against Cincinnati. I had a feeling we'd see him again when they announced Tyrod Taylor as the starter. I did not know it would be this soon. They signed Josh Johnson as a backup, a guy in the Tyrod Taylor mold. Do you expect the Bills to compete against Cincinnati with EJ Manuel jumping in here at quarterback?
it's going to be more difficult, but he stylistically, I think, has some similarities to Taylor. He's not as dynamic a mover, and he doesn't read the field with as much clarity, which is not a great statement to make because Taylor's still very much developing in that sense. Why did you think we would see Manuel? Are you concerned about Taylor's injuries or not sold on him as a player?
Honestly, when we were in Buffalo, I got the sense that he was the third man in that QB race with Matt Cassel and Tyrod Taylor at some point in the offseason. Obviously, he leapfrogged Cassel at some point, but I honestly thought we'd seen the last of EJ Manuel for at least the year.
You know, EJ Manuel, it's amazing. Have we ever seen a quarterback who hasn't had like overt problems? Obviously, he has no character issues. Everyone likes him personally. But he hasn't had like meltdown games. He just hasn't been very good. Have we ever seen a guy who's only 25 years old, was a first round pick, maybe not warranted in every draft? He probably wouldn't have been a first rounder, but the year he came out, he was a first rounder in 2013. Have we ever seen one fade away so quickly and it just kind of be regarded league wide as he's a backup now?
I'm trying to think in the last few years in the first round, guys that really haven't gotten a humongous opportunity. I don't have one for you.
I'm trying to remember Cade McCown.
You're going way far. Way back.
And I guess it's Cade McNown. That's the one that comes to mind for me. I have no idea.
EJ so far in his career, 14 starts. The team is 6-8 in those starts. He's completed about 58% of his passes, which was pretty good 20 years ago, but today considered somewhat pedestrian. And well, let's see here. He's got 16 touchdowns and 12 picks. So he hasn't been atrocious.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Like, I don't think he's a great guy. Look, he's got issues with downfield passing. This would sound obvious, but you don't see this as much in the NFL. The further he throws the ball downfield, the less accurate he becomes. It's drastic. He is not a good downfield outside the numbers thrower. And the other thing he needs to learn is to eliminate what's not open quicker. That's a big part of quarterbacking that people don't think about. A tendency to stay on a bad read too long. And the great ones recognize a bad read almost before it manifests. That's going to be the key. And Greg Roman's going to have to hide these. You're not going to ask Emmanuel to make a lot of progression reads. You're going to have to use screen passes, wide receiver screens, pick routes, wheel routes, stuff where he just drops back and throws the ball on time.
The last item that we want to get to here, the Lions are 0-5. They are the last remaining winless team, and I think we have 4 or 5 undefeated teams, if I'm not mistaken. How often does that happen where you've got...
I know, I was in their powerhouse teams. They're the teams we would have expected, too. It's Green Bay, it's New England, not Cincinnati not so Cincinnati. Much, I know, but Green Bay, New England, Denver. This is probably, I guess, is this like our farewell to the Lions? Is that what we're talking about
I think
so
that,
much?
Yeah, this is going to be RIP for the Lions because we've narrowed down the games that we want to preview every week. This might be our last Lions chat. And we've got a question here befitting that. Zachary at Zeke Berger asks, should the Lions blow everything up now or wait until the offseason? I'm interested in hearing your thoughts on Joe Lombardi. He was a guy that I heard a few times when I was writing my story on head coaching candidates for the next few years. People saw him as an up-and-comer, somebody who could get a job in 3 or 4 years with success in that Lions offense. Now there's a rising voice of the fan, I guess you would call it, calling for his firing, the offense being boring, not dynamic at all, certainly not producing the kind of yards and points that Lions fans would expect with a team quarterbacked by Matt Stafford with Calvin Johnson at wide receiver. Do you think that they end up going a different direction at the end of this season or in the middle of this season or even that they should?
I don't know that they should because Joe Lombardi, you said he was on the head coaching, some people's head coaching list, maybe the long list, not the short list, but he was good. This offense was productive last year, not as explosive statistically, but I think anyone that watched Detroit and has seen them over the years thought it was a much more controlled, sustainable offense last season. The problem now is their running game has vanished, and it starts with an offensive line that's really just not very athletic. They're trying to work Laken Tomlinson in at left guard. When you're young and you don't know what you're doing, you never never going to play to your athleticism. On the right side, they've had all kinds of personnel switches, trying to find the right guys, trying to find healthy guys. None of them can move, though. And the reason that's an extra big deal with Detroit is they're not a wide-open offense. It seems like they would be with Stafford and Johnson, and Lombardi comes from the Saints. But the Saints have always been built on pass protection first, balance from the running game, and the screen game. And all three of those items require decency from the offensive line. You don't have to have a great one, but you have to be able to compete with them. So this team isn't really built to line up and throw out a three-step timing on empty sets and spread the field horizontally every single down the way people are expecting. They're not built to hide their offensive line. They're built to play with one, and right now they're not able to do that. So you could say, well, the play calling's been bad, but a lot of play calling would look bad if there's no run game and an offensive line that you can't trust in protection, even when you give them extra bodies to help.
Yeah. You wrote an article on the topic this week, and in it you write, you know, maybe the 2015 Lions aren't a disappointing aberration. Maybe the 2014 Lions were just a pleasant surprise. And you make note of the fact that four of Detroit's 11 wins last year came in games decided by 4 points or less. I think we could be looking at another coaching blow up, if not at the head coaching level, at the coordinator level here in midseason. And that will presumably be the next time we talk about the Lions.
Yeah, presumably. And I never know how to handle those close game stats, because you could also make the argument that 4 wins on close games, and in their case, they were Matthew Stafford-led comeback drives, you could argue that's just as impressive as a blowout win. But the reason I brought it up, and I wrote this in the Lions preview at the front of the year, I watched every game of theirs on film last season. I never got the impression I was watching a great team. And there was times where they had a great record, or they had great wins. But they were built largely on their athletic front seven. That got overhauled in the offseason. DeAndre Levy's been out. They have a secondary they need to hide, and they have an offensive line they need to hide. Those are two weaknesses that are easily exploited. I was worried they would get exploited this year. So I do think last year's Lions were more of an aberration than what to expect there.
Yeah.
I don't know if you blow up the team, though, Robert. Let me ask this. What would that accomplish? Let's say you fire – we're talking about Lombardi now. Let's throw Terrell Austin in there, who I'm sure was also on your head coaching research.
Very high on that list.
So if you were to fire these guys, what would you be accomplishing? What's the mission in that?
Yeah, I don't think that anything positive comes out of it. I think in most cases, unless these guys have completely lost the locker room, and I don't have that sense, you stick with the staff at least until the end of the year, and then you rebuild in the offseason.
What about, all right, let's say Detroit finishes 4-12 and things kind of go the way they're going now, maybe even worse than 4-12. Are you saying they absolutely need to revamp their coaching staff, though?
I think that you can go ahead and replace the offensive coordinator, maybe draft a quarterback in the first round to compete with Matt Stafford, and you'll satisfy a lot of the demand for changeover. I mean, you got to remember, all of these decisions don't exactly make sense in a football standpoint all the time. A lot of them are based on, you know, the whims of fans, especially in places like Detroit, where the market and the support for the team is somewhat tenuous.
I don't disagree with that. I think that's also a good way to become the next version of the Lions, where playoff futility is the hallmark of your franchise.
Yeah. Well, let's jump from there to your conversation with the boss, Peter King, this week. I haven't even heard this, so I'm excited to hear it.
So, okay, Peter, you did the Fine 15 earlier this week, I guess on Tuesday. And what I found very interesting was at the beginning of it, you focused a lot on Charles Woodson. And I know the Raiders don't play this week, but you echoed a lot of sentiments about Woodson that I've always thought and shared, and I'm not sure he's regarded in that way around the league, and maybe that's changing. But you're talking about him, and Rodney Harrison brought it up as Hall of Famer, and it sounds like maybe even surefire Hall of Famer. You're a prominent Hall of Fame voter. Is he, at this point, Canton guaranteed to be in Canton?
I'd be very surprised, Andy, if he didn't make the Pro Football Hall of Fame. I always hesitate. I think the silliest thing is to say, well, if he's not first ballot, blah, 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 the system is rigged or whatever. It's always silly to talk about that because, look, there's five people who are – I mean, you can have a class of five among the the modern era candidates every year in Canton. And it always depends on who else is in the class. I mean, what if you have a class where there's Brett Favre and who, I mean, five other guys available or who come out that year who are surefire Hall of Famers. I mean, you just can't tell. But I'd be very, very surprised if Woodson doesn't make the Hall. But this basically was prompted by the fact that a week ago Sunday, I'm sitting at NBC, we're preparing for our show, and we're watching games and everything, and then the highlights come on, and Rodney Harrison sees the interception that Charles Woodson makes off Josh McCown late to sort of save Oakland's game, save Oakland's win over the Browns. And he just said that Charles Woodson's the best defensive back of all time. Now, here's a guy who's a Pro Bowl safety himself and who, in fact, was on the Hall of Fame semifinal list this year. And for him to say that about another defensive back, I just thought was the highest form of praise. But, Andy, the biggest thing that I wanted to get across about Charles Woodson, at least in my opinion, look, I'm late to the Charles Woodson party. I thought that he had some run-of-the-mill early years in Oakland as a corner. And I don't think he ever really reached his full greatness until he went to Green Bay. And the Packers, as you know, very, very rarely go all out to sign any veteran free agents. And they did for Charles Woodson. You said, wow, there's got to be more there than we know. And he was, in my opinion, significantly better in Green Bay than he was in Oakland. And particularly the year that they won the Super Bowl, 2010 season, this would have been February of 2011, I wrote about how I thought that he was as good a leader when you come back to really thinking about what makes a great leader. But, I mean, you had guys in that locker room, the Green Bay locker room at halftime. If you remember, he gets hurt late in the first half diving for a football. He breaks his collarbone. It's not just a little fracture. He breaks it, snaps it all the way through. He's crying in the locker room. His teammates are crying because they know his season's over. He can't play in the second half. And it was a classic. They went out and won one for Woodson. And I wanted to convey that memory because I just think that sometimes you're in the middle of a season, you don't really realize the greatness of somebody. And here's a guy who at age 39 picked off Peyton Manning twice in a game. And I just think it's sometimes we should stop to realize greatness in our midst. And I thought that was a great moment, a real kind of seminal moment in Woodson's career that I wanted to appreciate.
What always stood out to me about his time in Green Bay, he was really a finesse, almost, I don't want to say pretty boy corner, but I mean, his shoulder pads, you could hardly see them through his jersey for the first half of his career. He didn't look like he wore pads. He was a finesse corner. When he went to Green Bay, he became not just a safety, but a hybrid box safety, almost a position we hadn't seen before, one that Green Bay has since gone out of their way to make sure they replenish every year. Drafting Micah Hyde a few years ago was one example. And I don't know, have we ever seen a guy redefine his career in that kind of way? And he, by the way, he still stays finesse even in the box. He's made more tackles on guys without touching anybody than any player I've ever seen in my life.
Well, I think the one guy who you think of right then is another Woodson, Rod Woodson.
Yep.
But he never became the kind of I don't think he ever became the impact safety. I mean, Charles Woodson, going from safety to corner, or going from, I'm sorry, corner to safety, it's not like Ronnie Lott, going from corner to safety, because Lott obviously played the majority of his career at safety and was a better safety than corner. But I think what is unique about Woodson is that he has the majority of his real greatness came after the age of 30. And I will just tell you this, Andy, knowing a little bit about Reggie McKenzie and having talked to Woodson about this a couple of times since he signed his contract for this year, I think the Raiders are going to try very, very hard to get him to come back for one more year in 2016, because unlike Justin Tuck, who appears to be more of a leader first, player second. I think Woodson to the Raiders is a player first and a leader first, if you know what I mean. They need him in that secondary because, I mean, first of all, I mean, this is just me thinking about this. You sublux your shoulder, and your shoulder is in real pain every week, and there's never a question that you're going to play. And again, I'm not saying that the old way is the way that all young players should be, or you all should be playing through this incredible amount of pain. But Charles Woodson is going to show guys like DJ Hayden, you know, and the young players in that secondary who need to be shown, hey, you know what? I never feel all the way right. I never feel great once the season starts. But you just got to play. There's only 16 of these Sundays. If you can walk and chew gum, you got to be out there playing. So I think that's really part of his value to the Raiders.
Yeah, and last note on him, too, he's not just some old man playing center field, kind of hiding him, reading the QB. I mean, he'll drop down and still play man-to-man in certain sub-packages, and he'll still play in the box. He's also, if you didn't know his age, you'd say he's still one of their most important players, just watching the guy as an entity for him. You did your fine 15, Peter, and something I noticed, tell me if it's a coincidence or not in your opinion, three of your top four teams, or the Bengals, I guess actually all three of your teams, the Bengals, the Packers, and then your number one team, New England, they have three of the four longest tenured head coaches in the NFL. Coincidence?
I don't think so, Andy, because with all of them, there's a certain patient aspect to them. You know, Belichick, obviously, and Brady have been together for 15 years, 16 years now, really. You know, Mike McCarthy and Aaron Rodgers have been together for 9 years. And Marvin Lewis now and Andy Dalton, it's their fifth year together. But one of the things I really noticed this weekend, like if there's one takeaway out of week five, it's that the Bengals aren't going away. And that there's something that happened in that game that I found really, really fascinating. And you, as a watcher of tape every single week, when you watch this on tape, I think you're going to really get a kick out of it. Because the Bengals, they're down 24-7 in the fourth quarter, and they start to come back. And their first touchdown when they started to come back was Andy Dalton passing, I think, an 18-yard touchdown pass to Tyler Eifert. Now, on the surface, when I first saw this on Sunday, I'm watching it NBC, and I saw it, and I'm saying, that's the same pass, the same route that they ran in the first quarter on Tyler Eifert's first pass, and his first touchdown pass. And I'm saying to myself, hang on a minute. The Seattle Seahawks, the best defense in football, 2012, 2013, 2014. And at this point in the game, they are really frustrating the Bengals. I have never seen, against a really good defense, I've never seen a team repeat a play that they already ran for a touchdown late in a game with all the marbles on the line, because clearly Cam Chancellor and Earl Thomas are not going to let it happen again. But, Andy, I will be darned if Cam Chancellor doesn't pass off Tyler Eifert again to a guy deeper in the secondary. The first time, nobody covered him. The second time, Kerry Williams came over. He was late, but at least he came over to try to help with that, but it was a touchdown anyway. And I went back and watched both plays, and then I talked to Hugh Jackson about it. I said, Hugh, I was shocked at that. Was that the same play? He goes, yeah, it was exactly the same play. And I ran it. I called for it because I noticed there was something. And clearly he doesn't want to say exactly what the tell was, because who knows? Maybe they're playing Seattle again. So he doesn't want to tell him anything. But he said, I noticed something, and they didn't close that hole in the secondary. So he said, let's call it again. And obviously if the guy isn't there, Dalton can go somewhere else with it or throw the ball to the tuba player in the bleachers. But I just found it absolutely fascinating that this great Seattle defense got the precise same play run on twice for touchdowns in one game. And I'll tell you what, you got to criticize the Seahawks a little bit for that. But I give a tremendous amount of credit to Hugh Jackson for having the gumption to call it a second time, and for Andy Dalton being able to deliver a perfect football to Tyler Eifert. And I just found this sort of game within a game in Cincinnati. I said, you know what? These are not the 2013 and 14 Bengals.
Yeah, and that speaks to a lot of confidence that Jackson would have in Dalton, because theoretically, if you're going to run the same play again, and they're likely, it's reasonable that they would be the defense more expectant of it, your quarterback has almost no margin for error in that case then. He's got to execute exactly right. Eifert, by the way, has been a huge piece for them. I don't know if you how much you've gotten to see of their other games this season, but his numbers have equaled his performance on film. He's played ex-ISO receiver at times, split out wide by himself, which is something that not a lot of tight ends in the league do, although more do it than ever. But not only has he done it, but he's beaten cornerbacks doing that. They're a much more versatile offense this season with him playing the way
well,
he is.
Isn't it the case, Andy, that in all ways, you know, Jermaine Gresham, I always thought, looked the part of an NFL starting tight end. You know, really built well, physically imposing, had good speed. Did he ever play like that? No. Mm-hmm. Did he ever play reliably with his hand? No. Was he ever great after the catch? No. I mean, to me, I mean, and look, I don't know this. We can't know it. But what I've heard also is that he was not always where he was supposed to be on the routes. So I look at Tyler Eifert and everybody – and I wrote about this on Friday in my Friday game plan column, what's different about Andy Dalton. And one of the four big different reasons is that Tyler Eifert is a gigantic upgrade over Gresham. And to me, when I look at the Hugh Jackson offense – you go back to Oakland, Hugh Jackson always knew, and he's better off in Cincinnati because his line's better, but Hugh Jackson always felt like, this was my thought about Hugh Jackson, I do not want the hot receiver always to be the running back, because that, you might get 6 yards one time, but you're going to get -3 the next time. I mean, you can't rely on that. You can't build on that. So what he loves about Tyler Eifert is he gives him the post-up player, if nothing else, you can have him be your hot guy and run a short curl. It's what I think is really missing with Jimmy Graham in Seattle. To me, I think sometimes Russell Wilson ought to just simply say, hey, listen, be on the playground. Run out 6 yards, turn around, and I'm going to throw it high. You jump up and get it. You know, I mean, yeah. we need to move the chains. And that's one of the things that I think the Bengals were really lacking, because they could never trust Jermaine Gresham. Now they trust Tyler Eifert implicitly.
Yeah, and I've heard the same things about Gresham, and they were really looking forward to replacing him and having Eifert healthy for this season. Peter, this is fun. We need to do this more often. Real quick, what are you doing the rest of the week? Tell our listeners what's going on in the life of Peter King between now and when we see you on Football Night in America.
Well, on Thursday, I'm going to go to the Greenbrier Resort in West Virginia, and I probably won't be stopping in the spa there. The Arizona Cardinals are going to be practicing there, and there aren't a lot of weeks, Andy, during the season that I get to go out and see teams, but I think the Cardinals are a really intriguing team, and being away from home, they're a little bit of a captive audience. It's a little bit like training camp. So I'm just going to go hang out there for the day and see the players, talk to them, maybe see Dwight Freeney a little bit and see what he's up to, see Carson Palmer, and hopefully spend some time with Bruce Arians and Steve Keim. So I'll do that Friday back here, and Saturday hunker down in my office. I live in New York, so sit in my office and hopefully get about 3,500 words of Monday Morning Quarterback written with some of the early stuff. And then it's on to week 6 and play ball.
Season's got a great pace, doesn't it?
Iria, hey, this week is really, really going to be fun. I mean, I can look at, there's 6 or 7 games like Carolina, Seattle. Now that is a fascinating game. And you know, obviously New England, Indianapolis, you know, Revenge of the Deflators. It just, there's a lot of games this weekend that really intrigue me. Washington at the Jets. I think that's an interesting game. Cincinnati going to, 75,000 nut jobs in Orchard Park, New York. I mean, are they going to be able to be a good traveling road show against a suffocating front? And can Tyrod Taylor do some of the things that, with a better offensive line against Cincinnati, that Russell Wilson couldn't? So, I don't know, a bunch of games. Hey, one other one. I think Cleveland might beat Denver. I mean,
Why do you say that?
Well, because, I think I'm going to be in the neighborhood. 927 yards the last 2 weeks for the Cleveland Browns. No team in the NFL has amassed the amount of yards that Cleveland has in the last 2 weeks. And again, I know that Denver is a far better offense than they saw in the last 2 weeks. But I'll also say this. Cleveland was on the road twice, at San Diego, at Baltimore. And they go home, friendly audience. And Josh McCown, to me, I don't know, he's not going to be afraid of that pass rush. And I'm not saying he's going to do anything great in this game. But on the other hand, I mean, Peyton Manning is throwing some ducks right now, Andy. And I don't know. I don't think that, Cleveland looks like they're going to be without Joe Hayden. And that really hurts them. But I don't know. I mean, Denver's offense scares me a bit. So I think that could be an interesting game.
Peter, you got me all pumped up for Sunday now. I'm wishing we were later in the week. Thanks thanks for joining us. It's always a lot of fun.
Hey, my pleasure, Andy. Let's do it every week. Would love to.
Gotta love Tyler Eifert, a personal favorite of mine after getting me a couple fantasy touchdowns this year. And one of the people I was high on in the preseason after visiting Cincinnati. You go to a team during August or July or whatever, and they're always like, they've got one or two guys. The Bengals said Rex Burkhardt and Tyler Eifert are going to be really good.
Right, right.
And then you kind of take a look at the roster and take a look at what those guys did in seasons past, and you make your decisions. But Tyler Eifert was a guy that I believed would be successful this season. Before we get into our previews for week 6, I wanted to tell you guys a little bit about one of our sponsors, FanDuel. The Ravens, Chiefs, and Saints fans all took a beating this week. If you love football but you're sick of being let down by an awful team, take back winning at FanDuel. Now you can play with up to $200 in bonus cash when you use our code, TheMMQB, at FanDuel.com. FanDuel is the leader in one-week fantasy football with more winners and more payouts than any other site. They will pay out over $75 million a week this football season. Entry fees start at just $1, so there's a league for everyone. Over 1 million players have won money playing fantasy sports on FanDuel. Now it's your turn. If you're watching big games every week, FanDuel ups the ante and turns your Sunday into a whole new experience. There's a special offer for new users. For every dollar you deposit, FanDuel will match it with up to $200 that gets earned as you play. That's a bonus of up to $200. The offer is only good for the first 50 people that use the code TheMMQB today, so don't get left out. FanDuel.com, where every day is a new season. That's FanDuel.com. If you've never heard of it, try it out today. The teams on byes this week in the NFL, the Oakland Raiders, the Dallas Cowboys, the Bucks, and the St. Louis Rams. First, we want to talk about Arizona Cardinals at Steelers. The Cardinals bringing a 4-1 record into this game. They look like the toast of the NFC West to me, especially after watching the Seahawks last week in person. And the Steelers are 3-2. They run the Wildcat and win a game with a walk-off touchdown. I don't know if that sentence has ever been said before.
It felt like a basketball play, like a buzzer beater play basketball. And you know what was amazing about that? And no one talked about this. That was a true all or nothing. People say, well, if it didn't work, the clock would run out. They knew that when they called the play because they had a pull blocker on that. You don't call a run play with a pull blocker. It was DeCastro, their big pull blocker. You don't call that unless you plan on the play taking a while. Le'Veon Bell has to wait for that blocker to set up, and he did a good job. But that wasn't them thinking they'd have the timeout if they didn't get it. That was all in, and it worked out for them.
And they'd look like morons if it hadn't. I mean, who runs runs the wild clock with the clock running out? And how many yards do they have to go for a touchdown?
Yeah, it was a full yard. It wasn't inches. And that would be the second week in a row for a prime time, nationally televised game with an ending featuring what people would then deem questionable coaching decisions. Because the previous week at Baltimore, and I'm not big on criticizing coaches, but they did one of their fourth down plays was that quarterback sweep to Michael Vick. And I thought that was an exceptionally bad play for a few reasons. One, you sweep to the short side of the field, which they did. They didn't sweep to the – they were on the left hash and they sweep to the left, so there's less space. Two, there were no routes at all on that side of the field, which meant the defensive backs had nothing to occupy or think about. And as you notice, Josh Smith came down and was the guy that tackled Vick in the backfield. So anyway, that's a rant. But it would be Pittsburgh would have been our A-block story if Le'Veon Bell didn't score, because this conversation that I'm trying to force in here now would be the national discussion.
I could tell you really needed to get that off your chest.
I did, because it was Thursday, so I'm not like the podcast was done and I didn't have any radio stuff ready, so I had nobody to tell.
Yeah. So going back to this week, Ben Roethlisberger reportedly a long shot to start, but they're not ruling it out. I think in cases like this, teams will throw that out there, so you have to prepare for Ben Roethlisberger, but I would be surprised to see him come back until next week. The Cardinals lead the league with a plus 100 point differential. They scored 42 points on 43 offensive plays against Detroit on Sunday, just running roughshod. How impressed are you with the Cardinals' offense at this point, and how do you feel they match up with the Steelers?
I am very impressed. You could argue this is the best coached all-around team in the NFL, and it starts with that offense, which Bruce Arians orchestrates, calls the plays, builds the game plans. It's his concepts that define the offense. The Cardinals are unspeakably difficult to play against from an X's and O's standpoint. They use geometry to their advantage so well. They do so many things out of different formations, and they've got a quarterback that understands how to attack the intermediate levels of the field, which is why the geometry helps them, because most teams don't go that far downfield. So it's for a variety of reasons. You could put on five random plays from a Cardinals game and spend an hour marveling at just how fine-tuned they are from a football standpoint.
The other thing that's shocking to me is how well that running game has done with the two Johnsons, Duke and Chris. Chris Johnson specifically averaging 5.1 yards per carry. I don't think anybody foresaw that this offseason.
I definitely did not. And I will say, I don't mean to pour cold water on it, but he hasn't looked quite that good on film. Some of those numbers have been inflated. Chris Johnson is a guy that's highly dependent on his blocking. He's happened to have gotten the good blocking right now. But he's a light-footed runner that doesn't move the pile. We know that. But there are times this season where he is braced for contact running inside. I would think as soon as Andre Ellington's healthy, you'll see Ellington be the number one, and the other Johnson, the rookie Johnson, who I think I can't wait to see what they do with him as the season moves on, because he can line up anywhere. I would think he'll be the number two, and Chris Johnson will get forgotten.
Let's jump to the next game, Panthers at Seahawks. The Seahawks facing an undefeated team for the second week in a row. Imagine their luck. They get to see the Carolina Panthers, a surprising 4-0, one of your surprising, still undefeated teams. The Seahawks at 2-3 come off the loss to the Bengals, and where do we start with some of their deficiencies? The biggest one that I noticed in this game, you watched the Bengals consistently attack their weakest players, one of them being Kerry Williams. Richard Sherman lines up at left cornerback. They put A.J. Green on the right side of the field from the Seahawks' perspective and attack Kerry Williams. Richard Sherman at some point in the second quarter, I think maybe even first quarter, says, all right, I'll go check A.J. Green and we'll switch. And then you've got Marvin Jones catching passes on Kerry Williams and them matching up Tyler Eifert against in zones and in man coverage with Kerry Williams. Did you see that as a particularly weak point for them, or do you think it was just a bad day for those guys?
That's probably both. I think we talked at the beginning of the season. I've been concerned about Kerry Williams in this scheme from the get-go, and I thought he played very well in September and was a little surprised by that. But once a cornerback's weaknesses show up on film, they tend to snowball. And cornerback's the easiest position to attack in the NFL. So if you've got a weak link there, teams will find a way to get you. And especially if you are Seattle, where so much of your coverages are based on guys being stationary. Sherman does not travel a whole lot with number one receivers. And that was unusual that he did it with Green. He actually played very well against him once he did. But they've got another, they got the cornerback on the other side. Slot corner still a position in flux for them right now. I don't expect it to be an issue moving forward, but Chancellor was not good in coverage out of zone. You mentioned Peter talked about as well, the Eifert plays. The good news for Seattle is they're facing the Panthers this week, so almost none of this matters because everything Carolina does derives around the running game anyway, it seems.
I've been thinking about this in terms of, you know, building a team from scratch. I like to always consider how I would do it and reconsider it over the course of, you know, several weeks or months or seasons. I'll make a statement, and I want to know if you disagree or agree with it. If I were building a team from scratch, I think the ability to check the AJ Greens of the league is so rare that in my first 10 picks, I would take two corners.
In your first 10, like you're filling 10 positions?
Yeah, well, I get, you know, 53 picks of the entire pool of NFL players. I think I would take two corners within my first 10 picks.
I would agree. I would do the same thing. I you and I are in the similar philosophy there. I think you can the Falcons had an interesting perspective a few years ago, and it didn't work out for them, but the concept was interesting. It was Thomas Dimitroff and then D coordinator Mike Nolan with, I assume, the permission or the grant from Mike Smith, the head coach. They thought, we don't need to find a big-time pass rusher. We're going to draft corners. They took Alford, and before that they took Trufant. And we feel we can manufacture a pass rush as long as we have corners that can do what you're saying, check receivers, line up and play them one-on-one. If we do that, then we can figure out blitzes and how to get guys home. I like that thinking. I agree with it. Now, pass rushers, you know, some people believe that's the most important thing, and you can make a case for that. But I'm with you, Robert. I think you can do so much more schematically if you have corners you trust on an island.
Yeah. I think we're spending a bit too much time on this game, but I think we would be remiss if we didn't go into the Panthers and this hot start. Here's a stat that's emblematic to me of their season. They've allowed the fewest passing plays of 25 or more yards in the NFL. Obviously, Josh Norman is one of the breakout stars on this defense, but is there another player besides some of the well-known guys, Luke Kuechly, who you believe is making a huge impact, and specifically in that front seven?
Well, you mentioned Kuechly, and he's been out with the concussion, so I guess it would be appropriate to mention A.J. Klein's done a good job filling in for him, and he did a very good job filling in for Kuechly last year. The guy that people, they don't forget about him, but they don't talk about him as a star. They think of him as a good veteran player. He's more than that, is Thomas Davis. He has been a big piece to what they do. He's, when they blitz, he's almost always involved, which isn't often, but it is effective when they do it. Sean McDermott's very good at calling blitzes. Doesn't call a lot, but calls them at the right time. And Davis is also excellent in coverage, and he has the range to line up in the A-gap and retreat back in coverage. And when you do that, you dictate the offensive protections. That's what Carolina's whole defense is based on, is being able to do that. That's why they have the linebackers they have. That's why they drafted Shaq Thompson. Thomas Davis, I can't remember a guy who's had three knee injuries is enough in itself, but a guy who's had the injury problems he's had and has been as good in his 30s as Thomas Davis is.
No, completely agreed there. We've talked about the Seahawks a little bit, and they, of course, lose to the Bengals this week in overtime, one of the more exciting games. Let's jump over to Bengals at Bills. The Bengals 5-0, undefeated start, the best or longest undefeated start in Marvin Lewis's time there. He's been the coach since 2003. The Bills are 3-2, and as we mentioned before and discussed at some length, starting EJ Manuel at quarterback. Let's focus a little bit on the Bengals. One of the things that really impressed me about this team, on both sides of the ball, on offense they're able to exploit weaknesses. On defense, they were able to figure out how to stop that Seattle running game. They got gashed early on. Thomas Rawls has the big run. And I think part of that was how much respect they were showing Russell Wilson's ability and the idea that he might keep it and roll out either way. But they're able to stay in their lanes, maintain gap discipline, and stop Seattle when it mattered in the last six drives of the game and in overtime. And I think if anybody watched that first half, they didn't foresee that coming.
Cincinnati's been one of the most disciplined defenses in the league this season. They've played a lot of, they've lined up and just played cover two a lot of the time. I know they do this double A gap stuff, and they've done it a little more this season than last year, even though Burfict's been out this season. That's not their foundation, though. Their foundation's straight cover two, fundamental, keep things in front of you, tackle, defeat blockers one-on-one up front, which they've got the guys to do. I've been really impressed watching them on film this year.
Here was a surprise to a lot of Bengals fans and probably a disappointment to a bunch of fantasy owners. Gio Bernard, the running back in this game, gets 51 more snaps than Jeremy Hill against the Seahawks. What did you make of that?
Jeremy Hill hasn't played as well this season. He hasn't been as decisive as a runner, and because of that, he's not breaking the tackles or showing the burst that he showed a year ago. Is that a sophomore slump? You know, you can interpret that how you want. But if he's not going to give them the run game presence, there's no point in having him out there, because Bernard's better at pass blocking and he's better in the passing game as a receiver than Hill. So Hill, it's more about Hill just not offering enough right now than it is Bernard, although you're not going to ever criticize a coach for putting Giovanni Bernard on the field.
Yeah. Two more games we're going to break down. Here's the big one. I think the one that everyone in the NFL will be watching this weekend. Patriots at Colts. This, obviously, the Deflategate game. We're not going to get into that, but a little bit of background. The Colts essentially dimed on the Patriots and started this whole controversy, the merits of which we've argued at length on this podcast. Andrew Luck is practicing this week. No word yet on whether or not he'll be starting. I think that we're a little
bit... I would imagine he does. Right?
Yeah, we're a little bit more optimistic about Luck starting than Ben Roethlisberger. So you get Luck versus Brady. Brady this season, 1,387 yards passing, 11 touchdowns, zero interceptions. You would imagine that this is the game that Brady is really going to show up for this season.
If I'm Bill Belichick, I think I tell my guys, I go into my special teams meeting sometime during the week, and I say, guys, you be prepared to cover kickoffs because we're going to be kicking it from the 20 all game long, not the 35, because every touchdown we score is going to get a celebration penalty. I'm half serious on this. Just for the theater of it, I'd love to see this be the drubbing of a lifetime. I'm not a Patriots fan. I like the Colts. I like how they do things. But if I'm New England, I go in here to humiliate this team, and a team that they have humiliated the last few times they've played them.
Yeah. Who is Indianapolis's best hope on defense? Who is a guy that has to have an enormous game for them to have a chance here?
There are two, there's three. It's those corner, it's got what we just talked about, the ability to play man-to-man, because Brady can get the ball out by design so quickly that I think that neutralizes the pass rush. It's an average pass rush anyway for the Colts. You've got to be able to play press man against New England and take away the timing on their shallow intermediate routes. And that's going to be Vontae Davis, that's Greg Toler, and then whoever they put on Gronkowski. My guess is they don't have a lot of options there. It might be Mike Adams, a safety. They'll probably double Gronkowski, and you need to be able to man up to those receivers one-on-one. And then the other thing, Robert, and this sounds almost both sides of my mouth, the other guy's Greg Minuski, because he's going to have two game plans here. Watching that Cowboys film last week, Dallas was sensational in the first half. New England was not prepared for it. They did a lot of man-to-man out of dime, which Dallas has never done. New England was totally caught off guard, but in the second half, New England owned the Cowboys because they came out with the same game plan. I think you need to have a first-half game plan and a second-half game plan, and a lot of it needs to center around being physical with the wide receivers.
Yeah. Greg Minuski, of course, a defensive coordinator for the Indianapolis Colts. You have to remember, Andy, that not all the listeners know who every coordinator is.
Yeah, my apologies. And Greg Minuski also is regarded around the league as one of the funniest coaches in the NFL.
Oh, he's awesome to talk to. I got to know him a little bit at the Louisville Pro Day, and in about 3 minutes of conversation, I think he told me three great anecdotes.
Oh, yeah, I love that kind of stuff. Coaches are good. We forget coaches are teachers too. So they're good at speaking. They're good at explaining their thoughts, and when they have stories for it, it's fun.
Yeah. Last game we're going to jump into, Giants at Eagles. The Giants are 3-2, the Eagles 2-3. NFC East supremacy on the line here. Eli Manning in his second season in the Ben McAdoo offense, I think most would agree, vastly improved. 1,417 yards, 10 touchdowns, 2 interceptions, and a 66.5 completion rate. How do you think he matches up against this Eagles defense?
Right now, Manning matches up well against any defense because he's in command of the game at the line of scrimmage. And the more we see the Giants, the more they're looking like the Packers in their approach. And Manning's not quite Aaron Rodgers, but they don't need him to be because really the Rodgers plays out of structure. So the Packers start out as one offense and they turn into a Russell Wilson Seahawks type of offense. Manning is what the Packers offense is designed to look like. And he can execute that extremely well. And the ball gets out quickly and that hides their weaknesses. And then you talk about the Beckham factor and they're moving him around the formation this year. It's a tough offense to match up to.
The Eagles showing a little bit more consistency on offense than we grew up accustomed to after the first couple weeks of the season. They put up 24 on the Jets, okay. They put up 20 on the Redskins, okay. And then now a 39-point outburst against the Saints. Is this a sign of things to come or an aberration?
Aberration, based on the film. The Saints are not a good defense. They lack speed at all three levels. They can't man up and play, you know, can't go man-to-man, which is a problem against Philadelphia's up-tempo. Bradford was not exceptionally sharp against New Orleans. I don't know, I forget what his numbers were, but just from an execution standpoint, he still is not seeing the field very clearly at times. The Giants, do they take advantage of that? I don't know. They'll be tougher against them than the Saints were. I'll be curious to see how the Giants match up, too, because they've done so much zone this season. I would think they'd play man-to-man, and that's going to be a challenge for them. But if I'm an Eagles fan, you don't be comfortable yet with what you got. That offense is still a work in progress.
Andy, what if one of our cherished listeners wanted to go to one of these games in person?
Well, then they would use the SeatGeek app. Here's how it works. You download the SeatGeek app on your iPhone or Android. It's free, and it takes less than a minute to download. You search for your event, find a great deal, enter our code MMQB, and when you complete your purchase, SeatGeek will send you a $20 check to your house. It's that easy. So they're paying you to use their service. How SeatGeek works, it pulls in ticket options from hundreds of sellers online, shows you the best deals automatically. It's got a formula for that. When you shop on SeatGeek, you're seeing virtually every ticket option available all on one site. They also have a feature called Deal Score. It ranks every ticket on the market with the value score, and it plots the best deals on a color-coded map of the venue. And then finally, SeatGeek's mobile app makes the ticket buying process seamless, easy, and safe. So download the free SeatGeek app today. Enter promo code MMQB. You get $20 once you've made your first SeatGeek purchase. If you want to go see the NFL, college football, playoff baseball, whatever it is, use the SeatGeek app, promo code MMQB.
Before we finish off the show, we want to tell you about a few of our colleagues and some great work that they're doing on the Panoply Network of Podcasts. Our colleague here at SI, Richard Deitch, does a must-hear podcast on sports media. This week he landed one of his most wanted guests ever, WWE announcer Paul Heyman. Don't miss this special edition of the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast with Richard Deitch. Search for it on iTunes or visit si.com/podcasts for more info. We are going to answer a couple of Twitter questions. We're going to get into our non-football recommended reading, and that's your show. Chris White at CNilsWhite83 asks, can you discuss the difference between teams that rely more on scheme to get wide receivers open versus schemes that expect wide receivers to win versus man coverage?
Well, the teams that use scheme, that's a good question. The teams that use scheme are the ones, let's look at the Patriots, for example, and what do you see them do a lot? For one, they align their receivers in different spots to draw more favorable man-to-man matchups, get a receiver on a linebacker if you line them up inside at times, for example. That's rare, though, in man-to-man. Oftentimes, the corners will still follow the receiver, so you got to do something else to help those guys out. Putting a guy in motion, trips, bunches, everyone's all grouped up to the top of the screen or bottom of your screen. And then off of that, the routes will release in different spots. So one guy on the left might run to the right, the guy in the middle runs to the left, and whatever. It's crisscrossing. The more you crisscross guys, the more likely it is that defenders run into each other. And to prevent that, defenders have to back off. And that's what you want to do against man coverage, is force a defender to back off. So motion does that, release, stack releases with one receiver behind another, trips, bunches, that kind of thing. The Patriots are without question the best in the league at it.
Yeah, and I think that you'll find a lot of these teams that, you know, operate around getting guys open versus matchups as opposed to quarterbacks throwing you know, wide receivers open in man coverage is the former teams are usually the more successful. And when I think of quarterbacks who just try to throw guys open who are in man, I'm thinking of Colin Kaepernick or you know, early on Andy Dalton, younger quarterbacks who you don't want to throw the book at earlier in their careers.
Right, and that's what tends to happen. I had this, I called a coach a few nights ago because I got into thinking really deeply about Tyrod Taylor after watching the film, and I can't decide exactly what they're asking him to do at times, and it looks like there are full field progression reads available to him, but I don't know if they're asking him to do that. What you're talking about and what Chris White asked about is the other aspect of beating man coverage. It's isolation routes where one guy lines up here, you beat your guy over here, and the routes do not relate to one another at all. And I agree with you. It's hard. Quarterbacks that aren't experienced have struggled with this. It's the hardest way to quarterback at times, although there are some coaches that also think it's very simple because you just start left and you scan the field to your right or wherever you're going. So it's about philosophy. I know Green Bay does the isolation routes a lot, and Rodgers can beat man coverage with because he's such a good arm. But the teams I like are the ones that win by scheme. And you have to have an answer for man coverage in the NFL, whatever it is, because that's where games are decided ultimately, is on those third downs where man coverage is played.
Yeah. Last question is from Jeff Appler at Jappler82 asks, any previous comparable QB developments to Andy Dalton that either of you can think of? I mean, there are a lot. He's steadily improved into a Pro Bowl caliber player. I mean, he was never awful. Aaron Rodgers is the guy that comes to mind.
Yeah, one difference. So Rodgers is so abnormally gifted. I think mm-hmm. with Dalton, and what this question, at least the way I interpret it, is a guy that has some limitations that you have to work around. How do you develop a guy that's a little bit limited or can't do everything? And that's the question teams spend their entire beings and that's what football's about, is trying to answer that question.
Yeah, well, I mean,
how do you develop a QB?
There's 8, 9, 10 quarterbacks playing right now who are probably at the end of that development, and whoever they're with, whichever team they're with, figures that they're a Super Bowl caliber quarterback with their limitations. Tony Romo, Phil Rivers. I mean, those guys aren't going anywhere, but they're not what you would consider in the upper echelon of quarterbacks.
Not from raw talent standpoint. Rivers is pretty good. Romo was undrafted, so that, you know, that tells you he had limitations coming out. And maybe what Jappler82 means with this question is how do you break a quarterback ceiling? Because that's really what we're talking about with Andy Dalton, is which team has done the best job breaking their quarterback ceiling, or which quarterback has done the best job breaking his ceiling. Who's the biggest overachiever? I have mine, and I have a surprise one for you, but do you have one that jumps out to you?
A quarterback who you would call an overachiever. I hate labeling guys overachievers, because it's saying you're doing more than you were supposed to do. And that's kind of a meaningless thing.
Well, but okay. Yes and no. I mean, if you take a guy that was drafted in the mid rounds and you expected him,
I've got one. Joe Flacco, 2012. Cam Cameron is fired. Jim Caldwell essentially redesigns that offense to fit what Joe does well, and he takes him on a Super Bowl run.
Yeah, that's a good one. It's an easier one because Flacco can make every single throw. But I'm also picking a guy that can make every throw. To me, an example of surpassing your ceiling is Ben Roethlisberger in Pittsburgh right now. Not the injured one, but the guy that can play from the pocket, throw on time, out of three-step, five-step, you name it. Roethlisberger is the most improved quarterback over the course of the last 10 years that I've seen.
Okay, Andy, this is my favorite.
I forgot all about the recommended reading.
Okay, well, I'll just give them mine, and then we'll sign off.
Well, no, I'll think of one. Give them yours in the meantime.
Okay. My non-football recommended reading of the week is from motherjones.com. It's a long-form online story. The headline is Inside the Race to Stop the Next Mass Shooter by Mark Fulman, who is an editor there. Very interesting. Asks the question, is it possible, feasible, realistic, for law enforcement agencies to dedicate resources towards identifying and counseling, really, and preventing mass shootings in high schools and beyond?
The book I'm reading now is by Margaret Forster, who's a very big writer over in England, I believe. And it's called The Unknown Bridesmaid. I'm halfway through it, and it's been solid so far.
Solid so far. That's a great recommendation.
Thank you.
Well, thank you guys for joining the MMQB podcast. Please tweet us your questions at hashtag MMQB podcast. Thank you to our producer, Dan Bloom, our researcher extraordinaire, John Daigle. Until next week, I'm Robert Klimko. That's Andy Benoit. Thanks for joining.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.